Before we begin, just a quick note. If this conversation about alcohol, identity, and desire resonates, my new book, What Are You Thirsty For? Rethinking Alcohol and the Life You Want, is out now. And if you want to go deeper, slowly, thoughtfully, and in ways that genuinely nourish you, I've opened the Thirsty For More Mindset Lab on Substack. You'll find links to both in the show notes. Right. Let's get on with the episode. Welcome to the Big Drink Rethink, the podcast for anyone questioning their relationship with alcohol or simply wondering what more life might hold. I'm Anna Donaghy, alcohol mindset coach, author, and former strategist. And each episode is going to blend lived experience, psychological insight, and powerful tools to help you understand your habits and gently rethink your drinking in a way that throws open oodles of possibilities. So whether you're trying to quit, cut down, or you're just plain curious, then you are in the right place. Let's rethink things together and explore what you're really thirsty for. Well, hello, and welcome back to the show, where today I want to talk about one of the things that comes up so often when I'm talking to anyone who is rethinking their relationship with alcohol or cutting down or trying to quit. You know, one of the biggest concerns that always comes up is around social life. The moments when alcohol has always been woven into the fabric of the experience. So dinners and celebrations and perhaps most obviously parties, okay? Now, drinking and parties have become so synonymous that it can feel almost strange to imagine one without the other. So when someone is intentionally trying to drink less or stops drinking altogether, it's often those environments that feel the most uncertain because alcohol has been quietly doing a certain kind of work in those spaces. Now, my guest today is Evan Cudworth. I'm so pleased to welcome Evan to the studio because I think this is going to be a fascinating conversation, which is pretty universally relevant. Now, Evan describes himself as the world's first and only party coach. So if you happen to be a party coach and you want to dispute that fact, then let me know. But as far as I'm aware, he's pretty accurate. He describes himself as a nerdy graduate of the University of Chicago who came up through the underground rave and music scene. So a guy who knows how to party. And his work grew out of his own struggles with validation, with alcohol and other substances, and actually an innate curiosity around what people are really looking for in social spaces. Now, in the years following the pandemic, Evan created something called The Party Within, which I know we'll talk about. It's a framework that explores how people can reconnect with energy and confidence and meaningful interaction without relying on booze or substances to help access them. And today we're going to be talking about parties, identity, and the subtle performance that often exists inside our social lives. So, lots to talk about. Welcome to the show, Evan.
Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you for, well, we connected for the first time a few weeks ago, didn't we? And it's taken a while to sort of come around to this recording, but it's one that I've been thinking about and one that I've been, looking forward to enormously. So it's great to have you here. Should we dive in? I wanted to start with a sentence that I hear all the time when people begin questioning their drinking. They'll probably say something to me, Evan, like, I could potentially not drink at home. That'd be fine. I can do that. I don't think that'll be too hard. But I couldn't go to a party and not drink. Or only if I was driving could I consider that. And I think that that sentence reveals something really, really interesting because it suggests that alcohol isn't just a drink in those environments. It's part of how the whole damn thing sort of functions, really. So from your perspective, I'm really curious, why does the idea of going to a party without drinking still feel uncomfortable or for some people unimaginable?
So the word that's coming up for me right now is liberation.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think, not for everyone, but I think for many of us, drinking usually represents some type of liberation. When we, at least when we started, right? Whether that's, you know, the first drink you have with your high school friends, or, you know, when you're first, you know, that freedom to step outside what feels like a regular everydayness. And alcohol often represents kind of a threshold of freedom, of like letting go, of shedding parts of ourselves that we feel like it gives us the opportunity to do that. And what happens over time for some of us is that alcohol no longer represents liberation, but represents kind of a chain, right? Of it doesn't feel liberating anymore. Or if it's the only way we can be liberated, are you truly experiencing liberation? So for me, when you were first, every time I come onto these, I try to think back on the first times when I was trying to party or go to social events without alcohol. And I'm remembering a time I was in Vegas for a conference with work, and everyone else was, you know, racking up the beer bottles. And I had my little just water and tonic on the edge of the bar. And I remember taking a photo for Instagram of it and being like, I feel so chained to, you know, want to have this beer in my hand right now, but this is my freedom right now. And just trying to frame it as like, this is my liberation, right? Mm. It doesn't have to feel like I'm missing out. I'm experiencing freedom. Mm-hmm. And so that was just coming up for me a little bit of, I really always try to reframe it as, how can this feel like liberation?
I think about the first time, trying to cast my mind back to sort of my first ever parties. I suppose it was all kind of conjoined with a stage of life where I was, you know, allowed to be more independent. I mean, if you go way back, obviously way, way back, children's parties when you're about 6 or 7, you know, jelly and ice cream used to do it for you, didn't it? You know, there's nothing about the alcohol whatsoever. I mean, it was literally at that age, it was completely, you know, an unknown entity. So we used to party when we were kids without the requirement for anything like that. We wanted it to feel special. We were allowed to drink or eat more sugar than right. Potentially we would have. So there was a liberation attached to it. There was a sense of, you know, not the normal rules. And then, of course, as you become older, you start going to more adult parties. Alcohol, at least in this culture, you know, Western culture, tends to enter the scene. Soon, it becomes almost, it feels like the only way that we can enter the scene. And it feels like, through that alcohol, we are almost accessing a version of ourselves that we want to take to that party. Does that make sense when I say that?
Yeah. That yeah. Access a version of ourselves, I think, is true for a lot of people too. And some dangerously true. I was one of those people. I had a whole drunk alter ego. Mm. You know, my name is Evan. And in college, people started calling me, my drunk alter ego is Kevin, K-E-V-A-N.
Right.
and I hope this isn't oversharing, but you know,
I wasn't particularly imaginative, was it?
No. But I was, you know, and this is really getting into the Freudian stuff, but you know, I was even a happily out gay man, but Kevin was straight, and he was this, you know, Casanova straight dude who could kind of take on this identity of things that I might have wanted to be or that I'd repressed. And I wouldn't even say that I was aware even that I was doing this, but it was fun to like play, to be able to have permission to play that other role. and at least for me, like alcohol was an early portal to some of those things that I definitely needed therapy for. But but to look at that as it was the best tool that I had at the time to start to process some of those things.
Yeah. And for you in that particular situation, I mean, you had a whole alter ego, but I guess for other people, you know, the version that they're trying to access or that they're using, not trying, but they're sort of using alcohol to sort of access might be a more confident version of themselves, or a less socially awkward, less self-conscious version of themselves, a more talkative, less introverted version of themselves. Mm-hmm. But it's a sort of, because of the mood altering qualities of alcohol or other substances, it's almost the passport to, you know, to access that, isn't it? And to present ourselves in a way that we don't necessarily really feel internally.
Yes. Well, have you heard the analogy of alcohol being like a credit card?
No, go on. I love an analogy. Yeah. So go on.
Okay. Yeah. So I don't know where I first heard this, but I was bopping around on TikTok back in the day, and early on we were talking about this in this community that, you know, alcohol is kind of borrowing confidence from tomorrow to use.
Oh,
today.
Yes. Yeah. I know a version, right? Of this. Yeah.
Yeah. But that it is a credit card, right? And there's different credit cards and different rates. And if you have the confidence and the, you know, if you're able to like pay off your bill right away, there's nothing really that toxic about that type of a thing. But if you are constantly using that credit and you're not doing other things to build your confidence or to step into that, you know, the interest is going to come due. And also, there are plenty of people, I actually don't use credit cards anymore. I buy everything on debit nowadays, literally, as a person, because I want to know that I have done the work and I've developed and I have internally created the energy for me to spend in the moment. And so, yeah, just invite anyone who's thinking about that. Like, do I use that as we feel it maybe in The Hangover, or we feel it in these other ways, the interest that comes due for borrowing that confidence from tomorrow to use today?
I guess I agree with that. I guess, and I think that is definitely food for thought. On top of which, I'd also add that this feels like a very Western culture challenge as well, because obviously, yeah, you know what's, and you know, there'll be lots and lots of factors that play into this, you know, lots of dynamics within our culture that feed into this. However, what is really, really interesting is when you step outside of Western drinking culture for a moment, the whole equation can look very, very different. So if you take something like an Indian wedding, you can have 5 days, 4, 5, 6 days of celebration, music, dancing, enormous social gatherings, hundreds of people. And in many, many cases, there's no alcohol involved at all. The celebration is huge. The joy is incredible, which for me would just suggest that alcohol isn't the engine of the party. It's not, and I can't think of a better way of phrasing that than the engine. In the UK and in America and in sort of alco-centric cultures, alcohol does seem to be the engine. The idea of, well, it's the engine of the party. It becomes the engine within each of us as well. And I'm just wondering what you think alcohol has come to represent in social spaces here that other cultures are accessing in different ways.
Yeah.
Because we're all the same at our heart, aren't we? Why do we have to step into a party with a sort of a six pack of beers or, you know, a bottle of champagne when someone over in India or you know, another more Eastern culture doesn't feel that need?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's also making me think. I've been redoing kind of great books in philosophy. I think it was Nietzsche was talking about, you know, every philosopher has a congenital prejudice of sort of how they see the world. And so I am, yes, a Western man. Raised in Chicago, Illinois, like heavy drinking culture. You know, it's about to be St. Patrick's Day this weekend, where they dye the river green, and it's 24 hours of just absolute drunkenness. And there's a lot of community and connection, and the engine of the city is really run on a lot of those things. So every time I come, I wish I would have started this early in the podcast, but thank you. Like, I just want to say, like, while I have experience, like, I'm biased, I'm a paradox. I choose not to drink a lot of times, but to be clear, sometimes I still do drink on occasion.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just want to be aware of that, like, congenital prejudice that I do have for some of these things, and also say that that's why I feel like it was so difficult for me, why I had to invent this idea that maybe we do have this joy, this party within us, that we don't have to consume before that can be let out. And I had some evidence of that in my life, but I realized I had a lot of blinders on that prevented me from seeing how accessible that was for a lot of other people.
Yeah. And I think that what's also massively at play is obviously when we're talking about cultural level stuff, we're talking about social norms. And, you know, we've just mentioned the sort of the big party atmospheres in sort of Eastern cultures versus the big party atmospheres in potentially Western cultures there, with the sort of St. Patrick's Day is a brilliant example. You know, it gets messy. It's all fuel. It's Guinness, you know, and it's party. But I think the thing that always surprises me is how we just come to see it as the expected norm. You know, there'll be millions of people all over the country sort of sitting here now. Where are we on the 12th of March? It would be inconceivable to have St. Patrick's Day without drink. It'd be absolutely inconceivable not to be crawling the Irish pubs of any sort of city centre, because at some point it became inconceivable that you party without alcohol. And you go back to my sort of jelly and ice cream example as a kid, you know, that used to do it for us. And then we grow up and we watch our parents and our elders, and they are socialising with alcohol, and we assume, oh, that's what you do. That's what you do when you're an adult. And then you aspire to that because a teenager wants to aspire to be an adult, and therefore you'll sneak in your vodka and various things along to parties by the time you're sort of 15, 16, 17, definitely. And then you are in it. You're an adult and you are drinking. And then suddenly, if you decide not to, you're the only one who isn't. And then the self-fulfilling prophecy almost comes up, well, it's not as good because everyone else is drinking and then you're the one who's not. But St. Patrick's Day, you know, which you just mentioned, is brilliant example, isn't it, where it's culturally, it's a recognized moment in time that we sort of step into. It's a date, March the 17th. We're going to all over the country, all over the world, there's going to be people getting together in order to celebrate and drink. If we were going back to the example or the contrast with an Eastern culture, all of the religious festivals don't have that same almost rites of passage that you must be drinking in them. So what's going on there? What's really going on, do you think?
So I think what's happening is we have this innate desire as humans to be on a different frequency with each other. And if you go way into the past of Greek and Roman festivals, they would do these Dionysian 2 to 3 day festivals. And in some cases, you know, wine was a big part of those festivals. But there was others where, you know, music and dance and these plays that they would put on, these Greek tragedies, where people would literally go to, you know, have these extremely emotional experiences as a group together, but were very ceremonial, and there was masks, and there was a stepping outside of, this is who I am on my Monday through Friday, and right. I get to be this other person or thing.
Yeah.
As I cross this threshold.
Right.
And what I feel might be happening is sort of Western cultures have taken that desire to step into those other things and have maybe skipped a couple steps and just kept the alcohol.
Yeah.
And we don't have the religious and the Greek plays, and we don't have those anymore. So it's just drinking.
Yeah. I see that. I get that, because what you're just talking about there in terms of how it's been done in the past, you know, the culture or every sort of civilization has had its rituals. We're talking about rituals, aren't we, in many, many ways, whether that's dance or music or particular rites of passage and things like that. And it's almost as if, and I love the way you talk about it as crossing a threshold. it's almost as if we step from one thing into another, and or from one sort of state of being into another event, into another, then alcohol has become that ritualistic change. It's the thing that we can do. It's not particularly sophisticated. It's not, you know, as you say, like a dance or a performance, but it's the thing that we can do quickly. It's on tap for us. Because when you think about it, now you're making me think. Threshold moments show up all the time with drinking patterns, transitions from one space to another, or from one pace to another, one version of you to another. Those, every party, if we bring it back to the sort of the daily party scene, every party, those moments just before you step into a social space, standing outside the party or walking into a busy bar or hovering at the edges of a sort of a working event, it's almost as if there's a psychological doorway there, and alcohol has become the thing that helps people cross it.
Yes. Well, this is a little bit woo-woo, but I think anyone has felt this. Simply the act of doing shots, right? Mm-hmm. Of doing shots with people. Yes, you're doing something, and yes, you're physically changing the chemical makeup of your body after you take that shot. But I would argue more importantly, the energetic, we're going to all be on the same frequency together. Mm-hmm. when you clink those shots and you do that thing, you're signaling to that group of people, I want to be on the same frequency as you.
Yeah.
And so what I used to do early on in my non-drinking days, I would sometimes bring a thing of like hot sauce, sriracha. I would bring this to like a pre-games. And if people were doing shots, I would pour out some hot sauce into the shot glasses, and I would do shots of hot, and people loved it, and it was great, and we were on the same frequency, and they talked about it for weeks afterwards, and everyone wanted me back at the party because I was doing something that was taking us out of, we were getting on the same frequency, even though it was hot sauce. And that's what people want, is that feeling of belonging. And my invitation as a party coach is just to invite you to remember that you can demonize alcohol or whatever you want, but people want to belong, and people want to feel, they want you at the party.
Yeah.
They want you there. And if you're willing to create an experience where you're stepping outside of the frequency, if you're so guarded and so blocked off and so concerned about how you look that you're unwilling to meet people or create an experience where you can share a frequency, it doesn't surprise me that you feel anxious and that you don't.
When we look at sort of St. Patrick's Day, for example, that's a huge sense of belonging, isn't it? I mean, it's a patriotic, sort of national level sense of belonging, sort of the Irish tribal, pride in being Irish, pride in all things Irish. And there is music to define that, and there is dance, and there is singing, and obviously a lot of drinking too. But the drinking has become almost the entry into that event. It's become the means through which you cross the threshold into that event and says, I'm part of this. Why do you think thresholds are so uncomfortable for people, Evan? What do you think alcohol is actually doing at that doorway? Because I know why we want in. You know, we've talked about, I want to belong. I want to be part of this. I want to be accepted. I don't want to stand apart. So I understand why we want in, but what do you think alcohol is actually doing at that doorway that makes entry so much less uncomfortable? Do you think it's courage? Looking for courage going into party situations, social situations? Is it permission? What do you think it is?
I think permission. I'm going to use the word frequency again.
Again, yeah, okay.
Because I think... yeah, there's a frequency that if we're on the same substance or engaging in, or drinking the same thing, that there is a, and I'll even mention like Dionysus again, who's kind of the god of, you know, transformation, threshold, but also kind of like loss of the ego, like turning over the ego into a collective. And I think with alcohol in particular, there's some of that, of at least a belief that we're turning some of our, and that's why, you know, alcohol and mobs and those types of things, I think go hand in hand, because there's something beautiful and messy, but also dangerous and really scarily powerful about, you know, turning over some of that.
So here's an interesting one then, because you've had quite an unusual vantage point on this, so your experiences of Burning Man, right? So that's a very ritualistic gathering, a festival. You've been a few times, you've experienced it, both under the influence, as it were, and completely sober. So if you take that one singular event and explore that contrast, because the environment is the same, but the internal experience must be very, very different. So what did you notice shifting in yourself when you experienced that environment sober compared to, you know, when substances and alcohol were involved?
Yeah, and for anyone, a little context. So Burning Man is a 10-day experience in the Nevada desert.
Yeah, it's good that you described this, actually, because some people might not know exactly what it is, but it's quite a thing, isn't it? It's quite distinctive.
And it's been going on for 25, maybe 30 years, and started small, but now it's about 60, 70,000 people. We build an entire city in the desert. They go out there a couple months in advance, but the main event is about 10 days. It's very ceremonial. It sort of culminates literally in a burning of a man. And every year it's different, but usually it's something made out of wood, and it's very, there's drums and rituals, and there's a big Bacchanalia party after that. And then the Sunday, on the last day, there is also a burning of a temple, which has also been built, which is a place where people can go, and many people choose to leave photos or pictures of people that they've lost, or no matter what religious tradition they have, the threshold of entering that temple, even in a place that is a lot of chaos, is truly, I've been to cathedrals and monasteries and meditation retreats, and it truly is one of the most sacred places I've ever been.
Okay.
And that is burned in complete silence. And the people just the night before that were these raucous, crazy people, somehow 60,000 people in the desert that, you know, yes, they make it out there, but somehow they're able to quiet down and be most people I know are sober on that second night. It's a really interesting experience of what people are capable of. Mm-hmm. But now to answer your question of what does it mean to experience that, both, you know, the first two times I went, I was very much in drinking and drugs. And then the last two times I've been completely sober, did not take anything at all the last two times. And I will say all of them were good experiences for me.
Yeah, okay. But how did they feel different? I mean, did connection feel different?
Yes. Mm. And I always struggle with words for what it felt like. So I'm just going to try to speak from my heart here, but I'll never forget on the second or the first time that I went out there sober. And this was after like a lot of work that I had done, and just feeling that there's people that they will skydive into Burning Man and they will literally jump out of a plane and sort of rotate down as they're flying down. I remember I had gone to sleep. The way that I would do it is I would go to sleep at like 9 or 10 o'clock. I would wake up every morning at 4 or 5 a.m. and ride my bike out for sunrise, because sunrise out in the desert is just this beautiful place. As I'm riding out for sunrise, there's people that are spiraling down, and I just feel fresh and alive, and my heart is open, and I couldn't stop smiling. And I also remembered all the mornings where I'd been up all night, like kind of drunk, hungover. Maybe I actually had some experiences where I literally saw like demons jumping out of people's faces because I was on so much acid. But realizing I was creating those experiences for myself, and that the act of being out there and being, I felt so alive, and magic felt so real and accessible to me to see these people jumping out of this airplane. And I danced all morning, and I held hands with strangers and people, and I just got to help, and I felt so full of purpose and happy and alive. And I took photos of my mom, who had passed away, to that temple, and just like weeping out of, like, the party was within me the whole time, and I didn't need those things to cross the threshold. Yes, they helped me at that period of my life, but the liberation and the freedom that I felt to know that I could dance just as much as everyone else, it didn't feel cringy. It didn't feel fake. It didn't feel any of those things to me. It felt all very natural and real. And yes, it took work and it took me to get to that. But sorry, a long answer, but I just say it, like, it was just such a clear example to me that I truly had all the tools that I needed within me to experience that crossing of the threshold, but I had to learn new tools to access them.
Yeah. So it sounds though as well that when you cross the threshold without substances, without alcohol, you entered a space that was very different from the space that you would have entered had you crossed that threshold, as you had on previous occasions with alcohol. And to be honest, it feels like a much more beautiful, less scary, more calm, more authentic space.
Yes.
You know, the way you describe it, it you crossed the same threshold twice, one with and one without the substance, one with and one without the alcohol, and your experiences on the other side were dramatically different. Now, when you went the first couple of times and you were high or, you know, tripping or whatever, you didn't have a bad time. But in comparison to the more au naturel version of you, I guess what it demonstrates is, I love that phrase, the party within, because I didn't really understand it the first time we spoke, but I think I do now. It's basically, you don't need anything other than what you naturally innately have to belong, to connect, to enter those spaces, to be yourself. But we've come to believe that we do. And I'm guessing, therefore, that your framework, or I know that your framework, is very much about exploring and understanding what you do innately have in you that you can bring to those spaces. Have I read that right? Have I got that right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
So we outsource, don't we? We outsource. Yeah. Alcohol has become, I've got to go to a party. Oh, God, okay, well, I've got to get some alcohol. In fact, I'm going to have some before I even go. And then I'm certainly going to have some line there, because I need energy. I need confidence. I need to feel loose. I need to feel, you know, less inhibited. I need to feel this. I need to feel that. So I'm going to outsource all of that. And what you're saying is, I'm not outsourcing it. It's all there. It's all there. You can kind of reclaim it. You can tap into it.
Yes.
Amazing.
Yes. And that if I was hearing this for the first time, you know, before I had been through this process, I would have been like, I don't think so. You know, I would have been very skeptical of that.
Mm.
And what's coming to mind right now, I think I don't know if I've used this analogy before, but I'm a big Star Wars nerd too. And do you remember that the scene when Luke goes to Yoda on Dagobah and he's like moving the rocks around, right? And even that for him is crazy. And then his ship falls into the swamp and Yoda basically tells, you know, Luke, you know, it's the same thing, right? It's no different to lift this than it is the rock. But to Luke's mind, it still is. It's different. It's bigger. It's physically bigger. It's different. And it is true that we are in a reality in which a lot of other people use alcohol and substances to be confident, to be courageous, to connect and do those types of things. And it is possible for, I believe, every single person to, the same way that Yoda lifts that out of the swamp, that you can feel those same things, but you get to go through a process. You have to build your own thresholds. You have to, like, reps in a gym, you know, you have to lift small rocks first, that this won't happen immediately, that this takes practice, that this is just like putting on muscle or meditation or any other skill to find that party within you. It's possible, but trust that it maybe won't feel there right away.
So are you saying that when you talk about reps and you talk about building that muscle and being able to sort of access that party within, are you talking about experimenting and going to parties without drinking and building up a sort of repeated experience. Oh, okay, I get it. I can do this. I can do this. And I enjoyed that rather more. And I actually had a much better time last night than I thought I did. So is the practice going to parties and realizing evidence-based that it is every bit as good, if not different, but great? Or are you saying that there are things you can do long before you get to the threshold of a party to connect with that energy that you want to bring to a party?
Yes to both. Oh. Because when I first started this party coaching thing, I really wanted to be exposure therapy, basically. People come to me that wanted more confidence, or they wanted to party without substances. We would literally just jump right in. I would coach them and guide them as they would that weekend, you know, go to a rave or go to a party. And yes, that was effective in certain ways, but I've learned that there are so many things that we can be doing outside of the party to prep us for when we step in.
For example,
the 7-stage process that I have with this party within,
mm-hmm.
the first 2 stages are quite internal and mental. I have people do what I call it like a dopamine detox or a detox from positivity, where this is 48 hours to 72 hours away from social media, away from everything, just walking, listening, you know, clean diet, things like there, but just quieting down.
Mm-hmm.
Your nervous system from all of these stimuli that we're getting in other places. And just starting to become aware of what are those cravings that you have, even if they're not alcohol, to scroll or to, you know, to change, to try to control your environment with outside things. And just bringing awareness to that is a first step. And stage 2 is making peace with, I call it make peace with ghosts, which are like your past identities, the versions of yourself, the kid who went to St. Patrick's Day and felt belonging and felt like this is a place that I'm on the same frequency. I feel like this is what life is about, and to love that person and that version of you and make peace with it without toxifying or make the people that do that are wrong. Like just realizing that was a belonging for here, and what I'm stepping into now might not be a part of that anymore.
Yeah, but that's an interesting point though, because if you come back to that threshold moment, just for a second, that principle of thresholds, when people are experimenting with drinking less or not drinking, there can be a period when social life feels obviously really unfamiliar, and it's the social identity that you know, the old social identity isn't there anymore. But the new one hasn't settled yet. So you know you don't want to go to parties anymore. You don't want to get absolutely, you know, shit-faced and drink too much. But also your new identity, who you are in those spaces, hasn't quite settled. And the temptation is to, again, sort of almost numb that discomfort. It can feel quite strong. You can sort of go with the best intentions and then just go, oh my God, this is too cringy. This is too uncomfortable. So what do you think helps someone stay with that discomfort, that threshold discomfort, rather than immediately escaping it? Is that part of your framework as well?
And discomfort is a great next word for kind of the middle stage of this process, which I call spark the party within. And I ask people to do, it's a 21-day habit challenge. I also call it a wellness bender. You're going on kind of like a bender of wellness. But it involves 7 habits, including starting the day with a cold shower, even if that's 15 seconds for the first time you do it. But first thing you do when you get out of bed, 15 seconds cold shower. Telling your body, I can experience discomfort and it's okay. My life gets better. And
it's exposure therapy. It is. It's all these momentary little things that we might pass off as little sort of quirky things. You're saying you wouldn't normally do this, but what you're going to do, you're going to do it, and you're going to see that nothing bad has happened through doing it. And you're going to realize you can do things that are uncomfortable and stick with it.
Yes.
That you don't have to bail on the first, you know, in the first few seconds that you, okay, that makes a lot of sense.
Some of these other habits are dancing for 3 minutes alone.
Yes. Oh, I do that.
Yes. Lovely.
Love it.
But then it's things like, you know, calling people every day, calling friends, strangers, people you've ghosted, or, you know, these things of just reconnecting with people. Mm-hmm. And also complimenting strangers. So, again, just getting you in the reps of doing things that might feel a little uncomfortable for you.
Mm-hmm.
And what happens on about day 15 or 16, usually, of this wellness bender is people that are in these programs with me, they are just lit up. You can just see it. They're glowing. They're energetic. And they're ready to go to a rave, to a party, or to these places because they've gotten out of their brain and out of thinking their way, and their body is starting to interact and spark. That party within them is sparked by a series of habits that they've been doing that are naturally creating that energy that they had been relying on exterior things from.
It's a few things, isn't it? That they will have definitely awakened something in them. So they're going to feel energized, they're going to be sparked, but they're also going to have proven time and time and time again that that thing which they thought was going to be uncomfortable, that thing that they didn't want to do, that thing that they just thought, I don't have to do it, is first of all doable. And ultimately, they probably enjoyed quite a lot of those things. They felt liberated. What's really important, and with your bender, is that you're building up evidence as opposed to just basing it on assumption. Because I could sit there and go, I am just assuming, I don't want to go along to St. Patrick's Day, down the pub sober, because it's going to be crap and I'm going to feel awkward and I'm not going to feel part of it and I'm not going to be. But it's all assumption. It's all based on what you assume that moment is going to be rather than any evidence whatsoever that that's what's happened, because you've never actually done it. So I like that. It's a smart way, actually, outside of anything to do with the drinking realm or the typical drinking scenarios, of just reminding yourself that your assumptions are often BS. Your experience is often surprising, and we shouldn't base anything on a lack of evidence, really.
Yeah. Consider the possibility is my most effective coaching prompt.
Yeah.
Consider the possibility, and just making things possible to me feels like it's a party way of mind, right? Parties, yes, make things possible. There's lots of possibilities at a party. Mm. And this is not to force anyone or say you need to be going to St. Patrick's Day to experience belonging in the world. That's not what I'm saying at all. there are so many other ways to do this. I'm actually spending, so this is a Saturday, is like the big St. Patrick's Day here in Chicago. And somebody put a sauna and ice plunge on the beach, and they're doing like a electronic music night. And so I'll be spending Saturday night sober there dancing in a sauna. It's still going to be like 30 degrees. But to me, I plan that kind of thing in advance now, so that I'm not thinking all day of, oh, I'd rather be out doing this. Mm-hmm. Like, I have something where I know I'm going to feel belonging. I'm really stoked to meet some new people at a sauna on Saturday night when I would normally be like all blurry. I'll be like crystal clear and dancing in a sauna. So that's something else that I do is, on big holidays like this, or things where I maybe would be feeling not belonging if I'm not going to participate in it, I really try to create or find something that I can, that I know that I will feel a part of there.
And that's a really important part of this as well, because I think this comes up a lot in conversations where people are trying to sort of not drink. There's a very strong argument for just not trying to replicate what you've done in the past, isn't it? So what you're talking about, going and having a rave in a sauna, sounds bloody bonkers. But the point is, you probably, what you're saying is, I'm not just going to go and do the same odd stuff that I used to do when I was high or drinking or taking various substances. I'm going to experiment with new stuff. I'm going to go and curate new experiences. I'm going to Because of course you can imagine it walking into back, you know, back into the same sort of party experience that you've witnessed previously, and nothing else has changed apart from the fact that you're no longer drinking, but everyone else is still doing all the same old stuff. That's clearly going to be a bit more jarring than doing something entirely new and something you probably yes. wouldn't even have the imagination to think about if you were just still in the drinking groove. So it's a total carte blanche really for experimenting, curiosity, and that whole I wonder what, you know, the possibilities thing is.
Yes. Stop chasing nostalgia is one of the big things that I tell.
Yes.
I tell my clients is it's, I believe nostalgia is probably one of the most toxic drugs that we have these days. It's yes. all over, you know, people are want to consume. It's in the television shows. People want reboots. People want to recreate. People want to go back to these things. And there's this toxic belief that nostalgia will solve our problems.
Yes. Just
recreate what we had before. And there's things, I love reunions and I still go back to my college every year and I love connecting with them. But there's a ceremony around that. Outside of that, go do new stuff.
That's this. It's a wonderful attitude in life, full stop. Thank you for pointing that. I'm putting it so succinctly, though. Stop chasing nostalgia. I remember, I love going to concerts. I go to music concerts, all different sort of sizes of music concerts, numerous times a year. And I can remember the first time I ever went to a music concert sober. It was not long after I had stopped drinking. And I remember thinking, I fell into a trap of thinking, how on earth do you do a music concert if you're not, you know, a bit pissed? And I, you know, the complete flip of that was, I'm really interested to see how a music concert feels different if I'm not drinking. And it's only one bloody concert, by the way. If I don't like it, then I can revert, but this is just one day. A one-day experiment. You know, what's the worst that could happen? And I went along and it was, I will say, it was the best concert I've ever been to. There are lots of factors play into that. However, there is something absolutely electric about large concert venues and everybody chanting and clapping and singing and moving in unison, in celebration, joyful. And I was 100% present. And it was as if the volume had been turned up on the experience by many, many times, many, 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 many times. And I came home buzzing, absolutely buzzing. But I had had a more vivid, more engaged, more immersive experience than I've ever had because I felt it. And it was so absorbing. And I don't think I'd ever quite appreciated how numbing alcohol can be against the things that you actually truly want to be present for. It was my first example of, yeah, it's an anesthetic that, you know, takes the edge off the bad stuff, but it could take the edge off the good stuff too. Same when I went to my first big rugby match, international rugby match, I was so much more engrossed in the game, so much more present, so much more alive. And yeah. it's the aliveness. And if we could just stop, as you say, wanting to replicate the things that have done before and just start thinking of inventing, creating a much more generative sort of form of social life, new and exciting. That's bloody brilliant, isn't it?
Yes.
It really is.
Thanks for bringing up that word, the numb, as a word to, so my catchphrase or slogan that I say after when I close things out is live more, numb less, party on. and it sounds like that's what you're doing, right? Yeah, I hear this aliveness in you, right? And you're still at the party, right? You're there at the concert, but you're numbing less, right?
In a different way.
And that's my invitation for everyone, is that you can feel more alive by numbing less.
Yes. And of course, the other thing that's just dawned on me, I'm not very quick at these things, and it's just, as we're talking, something that's just dawned on me. There's no way in the UK that we would survive a 5-day wedding in the same way as would happen in, say, India. Because day one goes through and sort of peaks in the mid-afternoon. You know, everyone's feeling by far the worst for wear by the time the speeches are out of the way early evening. And the next morning is just a hungover, horrible mess where you sort of slink off slightly embarrassed trying to put the pieces of the evening together and find your shoe. Whereas if you've had nothing but joy the whole day, you get up and you do the whole damn thing again. You're not impaired. Your energy hasn't been crushed. You're not trying to just slink away without anyone noticing you. You're up, you're ready, you're doing it again. So it's actually the stamina and the physical capability to be able to eke out longer experiences as well. It doesn't come with this peaks and troughs of the alcohol cycle. I'm really conscious of time. I can wang on until the cows come home about the merits of, you know, socializing and actually, very surprisingly, partying in a much more enjoy. I enjoy parties way more than I used to. I used to go to parties with a sort of slight sense of dread because I knew what could and would probably happen by the end of the evening. And, you know, it's, yes, I wanted to go and drink, but I also knew that it could go wrong. So I was never really on sure ground, not really. If I was thinking I was drinking for confidence, it was going to pull the rug. It was going to pull that rug back, you know, like you refer to as a credit card. So now I'm a massive proponent for sober partying. So how do people find you? How do people find you, Evan? How do they sort of get in touch if they want to know more about your framework or, you know, want to talk to you and work with you potentially?
Beautiful. Well, yeah, I'll close with, you can find me at partycoach.me. Or if you Google The Party Coach, I'm on Instagram and TikTok. Just the one thing I'll close with is, we didn't get to it, but kind of the esoteric part of The Party Within and all of this is, we've talked a lot about ourselves, but if anyone who's listening to this podcast still made it here, it's not about you. If you can go to a party and help somebody else feel like they belong, if you can go and get out of your own way and realize that you are actually, your energy is contributing to that party and the party within you is actually there to help somebody else. And if you're able to dance, or if you're able to even hold space or just have a conversation or be present there and not think about what you get out of it, but think about what you give to somebody else. That's my whole purpose, is it's not about me. And when I can be sober at Burning Man and hold that space and be present there, I get TMs and hundreds, thousands of people that have had be able to have a different experience of the world, that felt more alive because of that. And people, because of you and because of this podcast, and because of the way that you show up to these things, you're creating that too. So that's hard to think about when you're early on in your journey, but for those that are kind of in the middle, remember that, you know, this isn't about us. This is about humanity as a whole.
Amen. Amen. Brilliant words to finish with. And so true. And I'm going to ponder that one long into the evening, actually. It's when you bring your whole self, the party benefits. Yeah. If a room full of people are doing that, then it's going to be a hell of a bash. As opposed to coming along, drinking, shrinking. I love that. Thank you very, very, very much. Okay. Well, I will put your contact details for people in the show notes. But thank you very much for your time, Evan. I've really, really appreciated the conversation.
Thank you. Live more, not less.
Party yes, on. Thank you. Party on. Love that. Take care.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening and getting curious. Please rate, review, and follow this podcast on Apple or Spotify or wherever you're choosing to listen. It really helps other people find the show. And don't forget to tune in to the next episode. And you can find all of my resources and become part of the Big Drink Rethink by heading to my website, thebigdrinkrethink.com.